Group Meeting, Sunday, 20th November, 1988.
Last month, we considered some points in relation to the body. The importance of the body is little appreciated by anyone. And the different religions which have laid down disciplines of religious living have tended on the whole to despise the body. Now I think there can be no profounder mistake than that. The body is a microcosm. It is the representative on the small scale of the total universe, the macrocosm. If there were no body, physical body, there'd be nothing like spirit or soul or mind or development or anything at all. The body is of the utmost importance. There's no point in comparing importance, whether the spirit is more important or the brain is more important or the physical body is more important. Comparison really should be anathema. Everything has its place in this world and in our lives particularly. And if we are intelligent, we will see precisely how valuable, how indispensable in fact the body is. Last month we started considering that. Now, we'll go on today with the same subject. How easily I say, my body. Some scriptures tell me it is vile, a thing of sin and corruption, of bondage and temptation and misery, doomed to die. Quite true. Those same scriptures also tell me of my great good fortune in obtaining human birth, for it is only through the human state that the realization of transcendence is possible. That the body is a temple of the Holy Ghost. You'll find this in 1 Corinthians, St. Paul writes, "Know ye not that ye are the temple of the Most High," and so on. And in 2 Corinthians he repeats that kind of statement. In the Skanda and the Maitreya Upanishads, the body has been called the temple. And the dweller in the temple is no other than Shiva, the third person of the Hindu Trinity. So the body cannot be unimportant. It is the abode of transcendence. It is transcendence concretized. Therefore, respect the body. Treat it in the right way. Realize that it is an indispensable instrument through which transcendence can realize its own transcendence through the human form. My body is a statement of fiction, of empirical convenience. We all say my body, or his body, or something. I have no exclusive proprietorship over the body. My breath comes in and goes out speedily. Food and drink likewise, more slowly. The cells of the body undergo constant change. What shall I hold and say, this is mine or me? It's all changing, it's all temporal. This body, a living pattern apparent to sense perception, is entirely dependent for its existence upon you and everything that is not this body. Self exists by virtue of not self. Not for a moment could there be my body or self if it were not for you and the world body, the not self. Let me understand this with all my heart. Free of the illusions born of isolated self-consciousness, the delusion-generating words, I, you, mine, yours, may all be used less misleadingly and less violently and uncompassionately when we converse together. Freed of the ownership of this body, I do not misuse it or torment it, nor can I harm your body or anybody in the world. To hurt myself is to hurt you. To hurt you is to hurt myself. For now I see that there is only one body in fact. The body, body in capital letters, which is the manifested totality, all nature, the physical world. Physical from physis, the Greek physis, meaning nature, means natural. All manifestation, whether I name it material or mental, for practical convenience, is nature. And nature is the body of God. You and I could never sense and worship God or transcendence were there not the body, the temple. Thus, body includes life, mind, consciousness. In short, everything that I can talk about, anything of which I can make a mental construct. And by the same token, mind, spirit, life, and other such words are seen as including everything else. For without the everything else, no one thing is manifest. The oneness of the total reality is irrefragable. Now I can reverence and love life. With my body I thee worship, as you have in the Christian marriage ceremony. With my body I thee worship. I wonder how many Christians realize the profundity of implied in those words. And the supreme mystery, God, the unknown transcendence, I can love, honor, and obey. To Caesar I can freely give my penny. Afore God I can stand in loving awe and pray that he take me wholly. And God adores the secret, the sweet, undeniable prayer and takes himself unto himself. This is death, the other life, for me whilst living in the mortal body. Now the temple sanctified by the ever auspicious eternal holy. I said, and God takes himself unto himself. There's a lovely Hindu story of a man who was worshipping in the temple, worshipping Vishnu or Shiva, I forget which. And he had nothing to offer except some food which he had brought with him. And he said to the priest, "I am sorry, I have only this to offer in worship. Is it allowable?" And the priest told him, "That food which you have, give a little bit of it to the God you worship, because that too is God." It's a lovely story. The Hindus have scores and scores of such lovely stories. Such is the supreme meaning of the yoga of bodily discipline, which must proceed together with meditation. Such is the state of chastity. To reverence the body, to recognize the indispensability of the body for transcendence itself, to display its own transcendence. And that is one of the meanings, I should say, of the word chastity. It's chaste, it's perfect. You know how when a craftsman makes something with some metal, and we sometimes say, "His workmanship is so chaste." When the dust of desire blinds my eye, or the wind of passion scatters my good sense, be still, I say to the body, be still. And the stillness of the body releases healing silence in the mind. Peace reigns, and the face of the immortal smiles again. The yogi, the mystic, the religious know this. They are the rapturous variety of the one, the yogi, the mystic, and the religious. And they are happy. Happiness is the crown of body. Transcend all the folly and pursuit of sensational excitement and fevered pleasure, and health, wholeness, and the holiness of creative action in its most concrete form will be the happiness of bodily existence, beyond conceiving and seeking, but which lies at the heart of bodily being. This is the purity of body, which complements the pure ethic of the heart, the religious morality. Now, would you like to ask any questions in connection with that or discuss that? And please speak loud enough for me to hear. That will record whatever you say. Shall I start you off by asking a question? What is it about the body which has made people who are concerned with religious discipline to despise the body, to say that it is ill, a thing of sin, and so forth? What is it?
Isn't it the senses which rise from body, which are like the horses of the chariot?
Yes. It's the sense impressions. So, how do we deal with it? The senses are like runaway horses. How do we deal with them?
Train them. Train them.
Yes, but how do you train them?
Discipline?
Yes. Now, in the section before the part I read out today, discipline means happy and healthy growing. How do we bring that about?
Accepting them. Accepting them in the sense of understanding them.
Understanding, yes, but how do you understand them?
Be still within yourself and sort of...
Pardon?
Be still within yourself and back off and watch them in action.
Exactly.
And thereby you get understanding of what's going on inside yourself.
Observe carefully without reacting. That is a very important part. Without reacting. If there is no reaction, then it becomes possible to make the right response to whatever is happening. Or whatever the situation is. Because why is that so? All our reactions are expressions of our particular values and beliefs, conceptions, misconceptions, and so on. So we react. We react for or against, which means, therefore, a continuous state of conflict. And it is this conflict in the psyche which we have to deal with. So, as you said, Brenda, watch. And watch intelligently, without reacting, that is. When there is no reaction, then it becomes possible to see the fact as the fact, in itself, its own inner nature. And if one sees that, then there is a real understanding of what is happening. And one can make the right response, if a response is needed. Need not be needed every time. For instance, take the response, the reaction of people to the state of the weather. Oh, it's nasty weather, or it is, oh, lovely weather, and this, that, and the other. Why do I say that it is nasty weather? Because it prevents me from going out or doing something which I wanted to do, and so on. It's a state of inward conflict with one's desire. When there is a storm outside, well, it will come to an end in due time. I remember very well the 9th of July, 1923. I was in Cambridge then, working for the long vacation term, especially the science students needed to do some extra work that way. And the 9th of July 1923, there was a God Almighty storm, lasted 19 whole hours without stopping. All the basements in Trinity were flooded out, and that meant, of course, that we couldn't have any baths, etc. It was very troublesome. But there we are, 19 hours that storm lasted. But it ultimately came to an end. And that was that.
Can you say a word about feelings of shame or guilt in relation to body?
Pardon?
Feelings of shame or guilt people seem to have in relation to body.
Mm. What about them?
Why have they arisen, particularly in the West? The West seems to have a guilt feeling about, and or shame, I suppose. It seems to be very much a Western thing.
Also in the East, but perhaps to a slightly, in a slightly smaller degree. The bulk of people in Asia, well, I shouldn't say Asia as a whole, but certainly India and southern China and all that part of Asia, they don't wear so many clothes. So they don't have a sense of shame with respect to the body. They take the body for granted. That is what the body is. There's nothing to be ashamed of. I suppose sort of general outlook on the body, which is faulty. But as the Upanishad puts it, and as St. Paul wrote in Corinthians, the body is the temple. It's the temple, and the dweller in that temple is transcendence itself. So why should one be ashamed of the body? It's the senses which start the trouble, and one runs, one is swept off one's feet with sense desires, and that causes a considerable amount of conflict. At the same time, it must be remembered that bodily pleasures through the senses are a necessity for healthy living. Dr. J. H. Campbell has written a very interesting book called The Pleasure Areas in the Brain. And if they are denied a certain degree of normal pleasure, the body gets ill and diseased. I think I ought to say something here. Why did I think of this sort of procedure at our meetings. You see, practically all of you are going to survive me. And if the work we have done here these 27 years is something which you value and would like to further correct in certain parts, because I do make mistakes, and develop, then it is necessary to be able to speak, to put into language your own considerations. You see, I tried this to a certain extent in some of our, not all, but in some of our groups, summer schools. But you all felt shy, I think, and didn't come out. Don't be shy. Never be afraid of making a fool of yourself. Because if that is the case, you'll never talk. Now who's going to call you a fool? Not I, anyway. Because I remember the words of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount. But whosoever calls a person a fool is in danger of the fire of Gehenna, hellfire. Well, don't call another person a fool. Don't call yourself a fool. One says it for fun. Oh, I am a fool. Which is true sometimes. As I know too well, with 86 years on this globe,
then you can laugh about it for us.
Exactly.
You?
Exactly. See, laughter and tears accompany folly, grief, pleasure, and the right sort of success. What do I mean by the right sort of success? Anyone tell me? Whatsoever enables holistic consciousness to supervene through oneself more and more easily, that is success in the only worthwhile meaning of the word success. Because thereby our humanity finds human expression. Expression as a blissful creator. Maybe I read too long a passage. Next time we'll have a short question. Yes?
In your introduction, Firoz, you mentioned the word nature, which for most people is a rather vague term. One can start pinning it down by saying that nature, scientifically, is the world of DNA. Everything that's controlled by DNA is nature, and it's the whole plant and animal kingdoms. So they have a community and they share the same molecules, same structures, and DNA is potentially a molecule which looks as though it has a capacity for receiving and transmitting on shortwave radio or resonances, but nobody can yet prove or disprove this area. So this opens up an interesting concept of nature, and is it useful to distinguish between nature and non-nature? On this basis, you see, a stone wouldn't be nature because it's inert, whereas living systems that are controlled by DNA are alive and active and can respond to circumstances. and have some sort of community together. Just how far they can communicate remains to be established. The green finger syndrome suggests that some sort of communication with plants is possible. Prince Charles seems to think so.
But tell me, do you think that there is the distinction between inert nature and living nature is a valid distinction?
Well, one can define life.
Life as we know it comes upon the scene with the plant kingdom.
One can define life scientifically in terms of all living forms have 9 homeostatic systems.
All living forms?
All forms of life have 9 homeostatic systems. And if anything manifests these systems, you can say it is alive because it's got these systems, except for viruses, which only have 8. And it's useful to know the difference between living things and non-living things.
Yes.
But in the last analysis, the differentiation between the two becomes rather tenuous. Because living forms produce some of the non-living items, like limestone and coral rock are the product of living forms.
Yeah.
Doesn't one say they're not part of nature once the polyp is dead that used to live inside the coral? It was part of nature when the coral was alive, because the coral created it, but after that it's dead, it's inert. But I think the notion is that it's responsive, can respond, it has this capacity for communication and some sort of communication and response.
I would rather say that nature is the totality. Everything is nature. Whatsoever is the manifested totality is nature.
Yes, you couldn't call rocks not nature. It's part of it. You go on a mountain and there's no crows, it's still...
Well, lots of scientists do hold this, that nature is only the living world, the biosphere. Anything outside that is not nature. But then there are some professors who are on television talking away, and they use the word nature to embrace everything, non-living as well. So it's a much abused term, and therefore... with no precise meaning.
You know, there is that statement, movement is life, or life is movement. But every single atom vibrates, moves. So is the atom alive or not alive?
Not in the biological sense.
Hmm?
Not in the biological sense.
Not in the biological sense.
Because it doesn't comply with the 9 homeostatic systems.
We have raised up that distinction. This is biological, and this is metallurgical, or whatever it is. We have done that. We have brought about a separation. But if you are conscious in terms of totality, where is the separation? Mind you, if you are conscious, not hold it merely as an idea. But I quite appreciate what you have said about this distinction between living nature and inert nature. To us it seems inert, because we are not capable of being conscious of the innards of anything and everything. You look at a rock, you don't see it move, you don't see it show any signs of life as we know life, and therefore, naturally, we say it is non-living. And yet your rock may be living.
It is quite possible also, Firoz, that in final analysis, inorganic chemicals or materials were interacting in such a way that the most primitive organic organism came to being, which then formed the building blocks for more complicated life, eventually organic life. It's not quite proved that creation was formed my virus is imported from other worlds or anything like that. Quite possible that in this earth, life was created from purely inorganic chemicals under certain circumstances. What do you think of that?
Do you know they are experimenting in Cornell University with trying to produce life by taking a mixture of hydrogen, hydrogen sulfide, ammonia, and a few other sorts of gases, and sparking them. And after a time, there is
amino acid, isn't it?
Huh?
Amino acid is formed.
Yes, it's a mixture of amino acids, which are necessary for living organisms. And so, it is not impossible that by the next century, anyway, they will be able to make a creature walk out of a test tube. But what use man will make of it depends upon his morality. Considering his present morality, he is more likely to misuse what powers he develops. Look at this genetic engineering business. It's a dangerous thing. One of the last warnings Krishnamurti gave in Madras, in his last lecture there, was in connection with this genetic engineering. And also the computer. What will happen to the human brain in consequence?
Maybe we're going to be transformed into stones.
Hmm?
We are going to be transformed into stones. What can be beyond just scientific knowledge? What can be the point in creating another kind of creature? There are too many already.
Yes, yes, I agree. But you know, that's the way of science, that it has to progress along any line of development which comes into being.
And you think that is always good?
That is the nature of things. But whether it is always good is quite a different matter. The Chinese invented gunpowder. They were the first, apparently. Isn't that so?
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't it the Chinese who were the first to invent gunpowder?
I think so.
Yes, and they use this for fireworks, which they use to this day. And also, what's happened with the use of gunpowder? So you see, it finally depends upon man's ethical development. What is man's morality? Is it a human morality or an inhuman morality?
When you were talking, Feroz, about the healthy body, I expect thoughts went through, at least particularly our women's minds, perhaps, of the diseased body through no fault of the actual person themselves. Mm. Can one become a vehicle for the spirit just as well through a diseased body?
Well, yes.
Can that,
because you see,
acceptance of transcendence help the disease to disappear?
But the disease need not disappear. I learned some very valuable lessons during the war years through the very severe neuritis I had for 5.5 years. Well, that was a diseased condition of tremendous pain, especially every night, because the slightest movement, and it's a shooting pain right down my right side. I could sleep. And it taught me many lessons. Particularly not to be critical about another person's way of life and say that serve him right. If he will eat these things and drink these drinks, he's bound to suffer like that. I suffered without eating those things and drinking those.
Surely we already are vehicles of the transcendent. We don't have to do something to become that. We are an expression of it already. Surely?
Up to a point. Because what is our stage? We talk of the human kingdom and the human species. But are we fully human? We are subhumans, various degrees of subhumanity. Until the purification takes place, which implies the right sort of development, psychophysically too. Then, with the influx, with the supervening of holistic consciousness, the human has become fully human. He is the true human.
But then,
and he is the instrument of transcendence. Then, fully, there's nothing to interfere. You know, in the Zarathustrian scriptures, one of them called the Vandi Dhat, which is Vidego Dhatte, the scripture which translated means that which is against the evil influences of spirits. You see, it is said that as long as the creative word is repeated, everything is all right. But when there is a cessation for any reason whatsoever of the repetition of the creative word, then evil steps in. But of course this doesn't mean any word that we speak. You see, we have the idea of the creative word that comes through all the religions. You have the Ma'amar of the Jews in Judaism, you have the Ahunavairya of Zarathustrianism, you have St. John's, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and so on. The Word was God, it didn't represent anything. Our words, each and every one of our words in all the languages of the world represent things, people, situations, conditions, and so forth. They are therefore as such not a creative power, but this the logos, as it is called, you see, the thought in the mind of God, as it is put in the Trismegistic writings, that is creative energy functioning. And creative energy cannot be described in any language whatsoever. You, by virtue of having become the perfected Holy One, can utilize, can express that creative energy, creative action in eternity. Not temporal action in time. Finite action in time. So you see, the business of watch. What's your thought, your feeling, becomes, and your action also, becomes extremely important. Watch it, watch it. God is the supreme silent watcher. But God is not a chappie upstairs who is doing the watching. Through the human kingdom, the watching comes to perfection on this planet. Goodness knows what developed states there may be on other stars or constellations or planets. I don't know. I wonder if anybody knows. But there we are. So this constant watchfulness. And watch without reacting. That is very important.
Could you give a definition of holistic consciousness? Could you give a definition of holistic consciousness?
Wait till my book comes out. By the way, the publishers have accepted it now, and it will probably be out next year, early next year.
Did you find a title for it?
I'm entitling it Holistic Consciousness. The managing director of Element Books is coming on the last day of this month to see me here. It's Wednesday the 30th of November. Because he feels that there are portions which need some editing, as it looks. But then the Heart of Religion underwent a certain amount of editing. John Moore was so very careful and so kind. And the editing was done in two long telephone calls of an hour and a half each. We went through every single page of the book. Oh my goodness, that's all been recorded.
Firoz, what about if this man is not that kind?
Pardon?
What about if this editor is not that kind? If he's not so kind as John Moore? If he's not so kind as John Moore, what is he going to do to your book with that editing?
Oh, he can't spoil it.
I hope so.
No.
You didn't talk.
Well, you know what I mean.
No. You see, every publisher protects himself right in the beginning of the contract. That it must not contain anything offensive, anything this, that, and the other, you see. This book contains nothing offensive whatsoever.
Maybe something he does not yet understand. And so he may think it's better without that. Because he may fail to understand.
He has written very enthusiastically and eulogistically of chapters 5, 6 and the epilogue particularly. But perhaps of the one of the earlier chapters, which is more or less a scientific thing, you see. I have titled that chapter The Very, Very Long in Short. I am accepting the Big Bang theory of the evolution of the cosmos. And there may be some points in that which we should discuss. But the professor of geology, the man who has the chair in Santa Cruz University in California, he looked through that chapter and told Noel King it's a very good summary of the whole thing. And the only correction he made was to change my statement of 4.5 billion to 4.6 billion. I have the photocopies of those corrections. It's quite amusing. Still?